The theme of this retreat has been the integration of compassion or love and wisdom in our lives, and to really hold them both in the same degree of preciousness. And so I wanted to give a contemplation on that this afternoon, on compassion and wisdom. I think it comes from the Zen tradition that compassion and wisdom are known as the two wings of the Dharma. And I think that's a beautiful analogy, because it takes both the strength of both of these wings in order for the bird, the great bird of liberation, of freedom, to really fly, to really be free. We need compassion in order to open to the wisdom part of our lives. There's layers of, and levels of wisdom that we open to. Just the very wisdom to know what to do. You know, when we're able to face something with compassion fully, then we're able to know fully what to do about it when we see the whole experience. Not just the outer experience, but when we see the inner experience, we're able to know how to respond with wisdom. And then that wisdom enables us to even go more deeply into the layers of our mind-body continuum to see what are the true causes of the suffering that we open to in life, and how can we work with those in a way that really liberates us and uproots the roots of greed, hatred, and delusion in our minds and hearts. So I can say that compassion is a wisdom, and to be wise is to be compassionate. So one leads to the other, and they kind of give each other strength, and it's a cycle that one strengthens the other, and we become stronger and stronger in this area of our lives, within our hearts. One of the things that I hear most about life when people come to me to tell me about their experiences and their lives is just what they're going through. I mean, usually I don't hear about the joys so much, you know. It's about this much, about everything else. And so, you know, this time in my life, and probably in many of your lives too, you look back and you can just kind of feel the rawness of life more and more, right? And that's why we need to be more aware, because it opens us more to the rawness of life, so we're not so caught in it. And the wounds of our life and the scars of our lives, and how do we keep going with those things? And so I was in a yoga class not too long ago, and the yoga teacher read this beautiful poem by Wendell Berry called The Sycamore. Has anybody heard about that? Oh, so she was reading this poem, and so many of us were like, you know, that sycamore is this body-mind. This is what I've gone through. So I want to read this to you, and this is just to open us to compassion, because the proximate cause for compassion to arise is really suffering, you know? So when we can really open to it and really admit to it and really be honest with it in our lives, the strength of compassion has a chance to really get strong. So this is the poem, The Sycamore, by Wendell Berry. In this place that is my own, whose earth I am shaped in and must bear, there is an old tree growing. A great sycamore. Thank you. that is a wondrous healer of itself. Fences have been tied to it, nails driven into it, hacks and whittles cut in it. The lightning has burned it. There is no year it has flourished in that has not harmed it. There is a hollow in it that is its death. Though its living brims whitely at the lip of darkness and flows outward, over all its scars has come the seamless white of the bark. It bears the gnarls of its history healed over. It has risen to a strange perfection in the warp and bending of its long growth. It has gathered all accidents into its purpose. It has become the intention and radiance of its dark faith. It is, in fact, sublime, mystical, and unassailable. In all the country, there is no other like it. I recognize it in a principle, an indwelling, the same as itself and greater, that I would be ruled by. I see that it stands in its place and feeds upon it and is fed upon and is nature and maker. That's very deep. A lot said there, isn't it? You know, it's the truth of how it is. It's facing how life is, and we all have it. It's every single one of us in our own way. So one of the most beautiful feelings a person can experience in relationship to all of that is unconditional compassion, where we can open to whatever is there and we don't have to be lost in it. We may feel it. It may be absolutely the reality of the moment, the passing moment. But it can also strengthen us. It can also strengthen us in ways that really open us and make us face the reality of life. So when our genuine caring can connect with the suffering of another person, and it becomes even more beautiful and sometimes rare for us as human beings when we can connect with our own suffering, then this unconditional compassion can arise. It's not only towards others or not only towards ourselves, but it has this beautiful open and spaciousness that can open to everything in life. The kind of universality of suffering, the universality of compassion. So, as Wayne was saying a while ago, you know, it is about our personal lives and our what's happening within us, but it's also universal. You know, we may have different stories, but dukkha, which is the word for suffering, is universal. It's no one is exempt from it. Unless, you know, we're totally deluded. But we're not, right? I mean, we're here because we're fairly awake. That's why we're awake enough to come to do this thing. So, when I was preparing this talk, I went online to look up something, and I found a lecture by Dr. Stephen Porges, who is the director of the Brain and Body Center at the University of Illinois. He's the one, his field is neurobiology, and he kind of specializes in the polyvagal system and what it does, you know, to the whole mind-body in terms of dysregulation and regulation of the nervous system. So he had a talk on the origins of compassion, kind of from a scientific viewpoint. And I was really interested in that. So what he did in this talk was he was trying to express as how we as human beings have a great need for this compassionate connection with one another. It's kind of scientifically known in his world. And it's not just about giving compassion, but it's also the ability to receive compassion. because we're open to the truth of how things are, the truth of suffering. So he gave quite a unique description of compassion from the place of the giver, and as well as from the place of the receiver, the side of the receiver of compassion. So this is what he says about the giver of compassion, that he sees with his scientific and probably, you know, very deep understanding of life, mind and heart that he has. So from the giver of compassion, he says, the compassion is a manifestation of our human need to engage and to bond with others. In the Dharma, you know, we hear that compassion is the quivering of the heart, right? The quivering of the heart in response to suffering. When we see suffering out there, or we see suffering in our own hearts, it's like this energy that comes up, the quivering of the heart. Mm-hmm. And what is that energy? It's getting ready to reach out. You know, when you see the green Tara in the Tibetan tradition, you know, she's the one that's, she's got her legs folded like this, right? But she's got one leg out and it's ready to leap. It's ready to do something. But sometimes, you know, actually the other part is also valuable, is we have to know when to do nothing in that moment and maybe just stay still because it's not the right moment to help. So to engage in suffering is a human need that we have. It's a human need to bond with one another. You know, they've been studying compassion at the Stanford University, and the thing about fight, flight, or freeze, you know that one? Well, they're finding out that there's one more kind of innate kind of propulsion that we have in ourselves when we're really connected to life within us, is the need to soothe. There's fight, flight, freeze, and soothe. I mean, you know it for yourself. It's like you're around somebody and they feel a little, you know, you can tell they're not so, they need something, and you just put a hand on them and they're okay. Or maybe they're not okay, but they're a little better, you know, than they were a second ago. Or you say something to them, or, you know, you just stay still and receive them. And because you're saying, I bear witness to your suffering. And you don't even have to talk about it. So it's powerful, this human need to bond and to engage with others. And hopefully we have the wisdom to know who those people are, you know, in our lives. So we approach to help, to engage, to bond. And on the receiver side, compassion is a component of our biological quest for safety. So we go towards people that we feel safe. We feel safe within their, you know, realm, within their orbit. Just being in their orbit, we, you know, there's a sense of a lot of inner feeling of okayness. And I remember I was in 2014 I took a sabbatical, you know, for a year, and I went somewhere to practice, and I went to a monastery in New Zealand, and very, very kind monk there that I had met in the Ajahn Chah tradition. And so I couldn't sit. It was really impossible to sit for me. So I walked a lot. I walked in the acres and acres of land that was there. And one time I decided, and it was a very, very difficult time for me, and I decided that I would do metta meditation, just go back and forth and do metta meditation or walk the acres every day. And so one time I was doing metta meditation, and I was doing it for my teachers, you know, all my teachers in Burma. And so I was doing the metta meditation for them, just giving it out, giving it out, giving it out. And I would see them at the end of the path. And then all of a sudden they were standing there, you know, and they just put all their arms up. It was like they put their wings up and said, "This is for you." And I said, "Oh, I forgot about myself." You know, I forgot to give compassion to myself. So just they're reminding me, you know, and What was I doing then? I was finding safety in the proximity of my teachers. You know, it just came up that was a deep, deep human need that I had, to find safety in the goodness of others, in people who really I felt protected by. So when we sense this compassion in another, we actually, according to Dr. Stephen Borges, we actually connect biologically with them. You know, we just kind of, in a way, we feel kind of like part of the chemistry of life, part of the prana, part of the life force that we're in their orbit. So we feel safe in this person, in this person's energy, just thinking of this person that reaches out, you know, and says, I want to help you. And even when it's just, you know, a vision of someone, it's great. It's a great, really, solace to the heart and mind. So there's a manifestation of our human need to connect, and there's a manifestation of our human need for safety, our biological quest for safety. So this is really, we feel this so deeply in compassion. So of course, when this happens, we feel that open-hearted flow, you know, that flow of feeling the safety of another and just opening oneself to that energy, and then being able to have a gratitude or compassion for that, for their feeling, their opening to their suffering too. So there is this kind of flow that you feel with a person that really gives ourselves a lot of strength. There is this unhesitating courage to face and to go towards what is hard to bear in ourselves. When we can feel that safety within another person, and then we feel it in ourselves, and we understand that also we can reach out. These are very powerful components of being human. So we feel a sense of deep integration. You know, really, this integration of love and wisdom for ourselves, for others, I call it a kind of sacred, holistic sacredness. It's just feeling whole as a human being. And it's like when you're in a big storm, you know, a lightning storm, but you're in a place of safety. But you can be in that storm. You can see all the lightning and hear all the thunder and experience all the rain and wind that's coming around you, like in life. And yet you can stay there and it feels sacred. Why? Because everything that's happening is nature, outside and inside. We really know that this is the nature of being human. And we have that kind of compassion that opens to wisdom that says, this is the way it is. This is how it is in life. And we're here in life to be able to face that and to know the strength of both and integrate them. So we have confidence that we know how to face not just what's pleasant, but also face the pain of life, which is a major, major part of our experience as human beings. I mean, In the ancient scriptures, when the Buddha talks about in the Theravada tradition the 31 realms of existence, have you heard about that? Mm-hmm. You know, there's the realms of the lower existences where there's a lot of suffering, and then human realm, and then the many realms, the heavenly realms and the Brahma realms. And so but I want to preface this by saying that you may not believe it, and it's okay, you know, because this is sort of like woo-woo sometimes. But Manindra used to always say, you may not believe it, but it's true. So anyway, I would just take his word for it. So in the 31 realms of existence, this human realm is fourth from the lowest. Yeah, and well, that gives us like, oh, there's so many realms of the heaven realms, right? That's not exactly where what the goal of our life is, though. But and why? Why is it that way? Because there's just enough suffering and there's just enough joy in our lives to keep us going in deepening our understanding of what's going to get us off this wheel of suffering. If you go more into the heaven realms, it's just too pleasant there. You know, you just get attachment all the time to the pleasantness, and you never want to get out of it. I mean, it kind of makes sense to me. So people, you know, beings, celestial beings, devas, they call them, brahmas, they live in this constant, you know, either pleasantness or just the high, blissful realms, and you can stay there forever and for many world cycles, but it also still comes to an end. We live in just the right realm to be liberated. So fourth from the lowest is not too bad. You know? this is a really good realm to be in, because that's pretty much, if we stay in the Dharma and we really start looking underneath everything, it's really one of our deepest aspirations. Mm-hmm. How many of you have already discovered that it's your deepest aspiration to be totally free? Okay? So that's what we discover. And those of you who didn't raise your hand, you probably have got that pretty close to the surface, but you haven't seen it yet. Yeah. Yes.
Sorry. I guess, I don't know if this is the same thing, but why I didn't raise my hand is I feel like my deepest motivation is to know what's really so about reality, what's really happening.
To know what's really so, that's your deepest aspiration. And when that can be your aspiration, then the understanding of how to come to the end of suffering will naturally be there too. So that's good. Yeah. So we've learned to face the pain of life, and also to have deep care for life, not to run away from it or avoid it because it's difficult, but to have a feeling of strength to be able to face the vulnerability of life. And this vulnerability, this ability to be vulnerable, is a great, great strength. You know, the ability to open to all the pain of life. So in some mysterious way, compassion makes us feel complete as a human being. And it leads the way to more and more and deeper and deeper and more, with more and more strength, to wisdom. The ability to really be free from all of suffering, from all the defilements, and experience the purity of one's heart and see that purity in others, or at least the potential of that in others. So we're able and willing to care for ourselves, which contains a considerable amount of distress, you know, in this body-mind continuum. And then we don't close down so much to ourselves, because a lot of what's difficult in practice and in life is if we come upon something difficult in ourselves, we close down right away, or we turn away, we avoid, or we say, oh, I'm going to find a better life someplace else, and just leave it, you know, instead of really facing it. And so this ability to integrate both compassion and love. Compassion and wisdom helps us to really face what's going on instead of either striking out, you know, blaming others or blaming yourself, avoiding, running away or turning away or just going to sleep and not caring, just using your life to chase after every pleasant condition you can. So when we feel this real compassion, it's celebrated in the Dharma as inner wealth, right? Because there's nothing that can take that inner wealth away from you. No matter what happens to you in your life, and when you die, when we all die, we can't take our physical belongings with us, nor our relatives, or our loved ones. Maybe some of them we wouldn't want to take anyway, but that wouldn't be such a lovely death, but when you feel at peace, you know, then you really feel you've got compassion, love in your heart. You lived with some wisdom, and you're able to feel, I had a good life, and they're, you know, able to really face death in a way that is helpful. I had this poem by here it is. It's untitled, by Donna Markova, and she says, "I will not die an unlived life. I will not live in fear of falling or catching fire. I choose to inhabit my days, to allow my living to open me, to make me less afraid, more accessible, to loosen my heart until it becomes a wing, a torch, a promise. I choose to risk my significance, to live, so that which came to me as seed goes to the next as blossom, and that which came as blossom goes on as fruit." You can go on and on like that. Huh? Donna Markova. So I want to connect the strength of compassion to the wisdom part now. In the Dharma, if you mention wisdom, one of the first things that would come to one's mind is the Four Noble Truths, right? This is the wisdom part of the Dharma. And so in the turning of the wheel of the Dharma, the Buddha laid out these Four Noble Truths, these four realities of life that are true. And when we can face them and we can accept them and realize them for ourselves, then it really completes a cycle of living into the potential that we each have as a human being, the highest potential that we have as a human being. So the Buddha started with the reality of what we're all faced with as human beings. Now, you know, in some circles, and I guess it's more in intellectual studies of the Dharma, when the First Noble Truth is translated, it's translated as life is suffering. And that's really a very poor translation of the First Noble Truth. So if you've ever heard that, forget it. You know, I like what in the world? That's not going to bring people to hear the Dharma. You know, life is suffering. But really, the two words of in Pali, which is the ancient language that the Buddhist teachings were first written in, the two words that describe this First Noble Truth is dukkha saccha. Dukkha means suffering, and saccha means the truth. So that is translated in, there is the truth of suffering. Right? Mm-hmm. That's much better than life is suffering. I mean, the other one's kind of true too, but there is a truth of suffering. When I first heard that, you know, I was raised in the Catholic tradition, which I greatly revere. I'm not one of those recovering Catholics. But I greatly revere what I learned in that tradition. And I still, you know, I'm close to it. But one time, you know, it was the first time I started opening to this understanding of facing suffering, is when I realized that, you know, where the Buddha's starting is where I'm starting. Like when Indra asked me when I was younger, what brought you to the Dharma, that was in my talk the other night, right? Mm-hmm. I said suffering brought me to the Dharma. Because I really wanted to know, what's this all about? Like you, what's this all about? And what can take me beyond? What can take this mind heart beyond that? And so I felt a great connection with the Dharma when I heard this, because I really felt that, oh, somebody's actually saying what's true for me. And it's not about, like, you got to get someplace else. It's about, first, you got to get here.
Right?
And so I really felt relaxed. I mean, even with that First Noble Truth, I felt totally relaxed. Because I felt like I was being recognized, that my life was being truly recognized. So that's the First Noble Truth. And the Buddha was a realist. You know, he started from something that's real. wasn't a pessimist. So there is a truth of suffering, and the other parts of it, which I'm not going to go through, it's sort of like its own talk, the Four Noble Truths, is the second noble truth is there is a cause, suffering, which is craving or want, or that kind of wanting that wants things that are unwholesome, basically. The third noble truth is that there can be an end to suffering, so this is the good news part. And the fourth noble truth is the Buddha laid out an actual path to the end of suffering, which is the Eightfold Noble Path. So I'm sure those of you who have been in this group, been in the Dharma for a long time, have probably heard that talk even from Dennis, you know, so from some of you others who give the talks here. But this first noble truth is something that in itself, to hear it, gives us permission to be human. And it's a great relief to have that permission to be human. And it really is about the full range of human experience and not to be in denial about it, but to really face that truth. So throughout his life, he taught that it's a quality of compassion that greatly supports us to face this first noble truth. And he gave compassion a vitally important role to develop on our spiritual path. Because we need that. We need the balance of compassion and wisdom to really be in life with both wings of the Dharma really strong. So in our practice here together, we've all seen for ourselves that when we face a difficult experience, it opens us to the first noble truth. And so it opens us to the Dharma. You know, when we face suffering in ourselves or in others, it's nothing to, you know, frown upon, because we can say, okay, this is what it is in particular. It's painful because it's aversion or attachment or joy that we're hanging on to or sorrow that we're pushing away. But it's really, sometimes I just say, oh, this is the first noble truth. Because it's kind of more noble, right, to be open to that. And then we don't get so identified with our particular pain. So that's the universality of it. We don't only open to the particularity of our personal pain, but we begin to open to the universality of dukkha, and the universality of compassion. So this is from Khalil Gibran, another beautiful poet from long ago. Your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding. Even as a stone of the fruit must break open, that its heart may stand in the sun, so must you know pain. And if you could keep your heart in wonder at the daily miracles of your life, your pain would not seem less wondrous than your joy. So it's really a wondrous thing to open to the Four Noble Truths, because it's taking us to the end of suffering. We need to start there. They always say in the Dharma, you can't go around it. You can't go over it. You know, you can't put it under the rug. You really have to go through it in order to realize the truth and to really be free. Do you believe that? Okay. So we live in this electronic age where the frequency and intensity of seeing and hearing and knowing what's happening affects us steadily. And that's a big reason to practice compassion. We have a lot of opportunities during the day, you know, to practice it. I mean, how many of you, when you get online, you open your whatever you have, your one of your devices, and you see the news comes up right away. There's a lot of people, and it's oftentimes bad news. You know, and bad news meaning it's suffering. There's suffering in the world, or it could be actually lies, which is, you know, that's suffering too. So we have so much opportunity, and we need to practice compassion more, because there's so much of it that is around us now. The frequency and the swiftness of it, and it's just TMI, too much information, really. It's way, way over the top. So we've got what's happening in the environmental area where many of us are very concerned about, and then it goes into the compassion where we feel helpless, you know, which is kind of what is the near enemy of compassion, kind of a helpless feeling. And then we, you know, have so much pity and maybe sometimes blame. But there's so much happening on the earth, the shifting of the changing planet, the melting icebergs, the changing ocean currents, the hurricanes, the earthquakes. Just recently when I was watching the news about the meetings in Paris, and I was particularly interested in the group that was there because of the South Pacific Islanders. Did I say this to you the other night? Sometimes I forget where I'm at. It was the last retreat I said that. So they were saying, you know, the group of Pacific Islanders were saying that their shorelines are, because of the tides going up, they're displacing so many communities. Like, just thousands of people are being displaced. And so, you know, we have an environmental crisis right now. It's true. So there's a lot of heartbreak about this. You know, some people are particularly connected to the dukkha of this. And then, of course, there's social, political, religious, tribal wars. I mean, it's endless. And it's not only been happening now, but it's been going on for world cycles. You know, so that's the universality of it. Doesn't mean we close our hearts down. But how can we face it? We need to have the strength to face this all. And then there's the racial, the cultural, the economic disparities, you know, the gender disparities and unfairness that go on in the world that are so gravely unfair. And this is tragic. This is awful. You know, of course, I feel it myself. I experience it, being a person of color, not in an awful way, but I experience it. I experience it as being a woman. And I just want to, you know, talk about the elephant in the room, right? So I don't need to go on and on about that, but that's not the stance I take in the Dharma. But it's true. It's really true. It's hard for us when we come from a certain place in life, or economically we don't feel so stable or so up to par of anyone else. It's very, very difficult. So, of course, you know, we feel it so closely, and the tsunamis that are happening in our own lives. So usually compassion is thought of in terms of helping or saving others and facing the struggles in the world out there with courage and acting to relieve it. This is true and part of our naturalness of being human. But it's important to include in sometimes even start with being open to the suffering that goes on right here and face that in our lives. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama said, until you understand the meaning of suffering in your own heart, there will be a measure of hypocrisy to your compassion for others. So as we feel it for ourselves, we're really able to give it out to others in ways where we're not kind of falling into, you know, the quicksand of their suffering, but we're able to stand on the side and say, I'll help you from firm ground, and that ground that is really compassion and wisdom together. There's a beautiful story in Asia that is included in many of the Asian Buddhist cultures about how there's a person sinking in quicksand, and then another person without much wisdom has this compassion and jumps in to the quicksand to try to help, you know, like, but also sinks and is lost in that. And instead of being able to help, that person also drowns or smothers in the quicksand. But the wise thing to do when we're compassionate is to be able to stand by the side with on firm ground and to be able to get something, to or even just put out your hand and say, take a firm hold and I'll pull you back in. And so that's why we need to be able to understand, you know, the wisdom and compassion together. So we know what the right thing is to do and we're not going to sink with them. So how do we experience this pain, this dukkha, this suffering? And the Buddha talked about it in several ways. When we experience pain in the body, it's okay. It's all right. I know, I do that too. I think it's off, but it's not. Okay, so pain in the body, hunger, illness, we experience dukkha that way. Pain in the mind and the heart, like sadness, hatred, holding tightly to how we think it should be, resentment, jealousy. When it's not like we think it should be, it might not be attachment, but it's aversion, you know, the other side of it, right? So we see also the fickleness of the uncontrollability of the mind. You know, like this gentleman was saying here, it's just moving back and forth. So, you know, it brings restlessness to the body and the mind because it's true. We see that what you saw, that's dukkha. That is, you see the suffering. It's out of habit that happens. But that's good to see. There's nothing wrong with that. So there's an inability to hold on to anything because it's always changing. It's always moving. And we're becoming familiar with this vulnerability of all of life. And then we come to this practice and we learn practices to help us have more stability so that awareness can actually reflect what's going on very, very clearly and not be bogged down by it, not strike out at it, not turn away from it, not fall asleep in delusion because of it, but we're really able to face it. So compassion for others grows because we know it for ourselves and we become stronger. So we become more connected and open to what's going on within us so we don't succumb to compassion fatigue. And that's what can happen when we're just open to too much information and we need to give ourselves breaks from the news sometimes and just at a certain time of the day make a decision that, okay, that's it. Close down all the devices for now. It's just one little piece of advice. There are the many things you could do to keep yourselves more balanced in life. So we start to see with more honesty elements of fear and anger, attachments, where we're holding tightly to our own viewpoints of life and others. Places of pain, of judging, helplessness, guilt and resentment. So we're learning and training to open to the truth of how it is, as you were saying. Opening to the truth of how it is. That's the beginning of the Four Noble Truths. And then from there, it gets to the possibility, the potential to realize fully the end of suffering. So I talked to you earlier in the day about using the acronym RAIN to be able to relax and recognize clearly what's going on. To be able to allow it to unfold so and untangle itself so there's this ability to see what's kind of been rolling and roiling on and fueling what the thought patterns that we have that's really the underlying cause and condition for the suffering we have in our lives. And then to take interest to going, you know, taking a step forward or kind of a stance that is, ooh, what is this? Instead of, oh no, you know, push it away or just go chase after something that's more pleasant, like fantasy. So when we can relate to it as nature, the natural unfolding of what has been accumulated in this body-mind continuum, then it's a relief, because it's a truth. Nature, this body-mind continuum is the nature of how it is in our lives. So I was reading the writings of Mark Nepo. He's a writer and a poet, and he's gone through a lot of suffering in himself because of his health and other areas that, you know, how it's connected with life and people around him. How many of you have heard of Mark Nepo? Yeah, beautiful writer. So I just excerpt one thing that he said that was in a bit of a bigger writing. This one touched me very deeply, so I made note of it. Having loved enough and lost enough, I am no longer searching, just opening, no longer trying to make sense of pain, but being a soft and sturdy home in which real things can land. These are the irritations that rub to a pearl. Isn't that beautiful? Yeah, so we see the other side of it. You know, we start seeing the end of suffering, you know. So all these rubbing up against painful things. But actually it's just shining that inner diamond, that inner pearl. Yeah.
Would you mind reading it again?
Okay, reading it again.
All
right. Okay. Having loved enough and lost enough, I am no longer searching, just opening, no longer trying to make sense of pain, but being a soft and sturdy home in which real things can land. These are the irritations that rub to a pearl. So in doing this practice, I've heard so many speak about and realizing the strengths that they had to get through life. And when facing them, they faced really their own strength. Their own strength came up to face the trials and tribulations and the fire of life. And I'm remembering a dear friend who cooked for our retreats a lot, and so it was a time in her life when she needed some treatment, and so she wrote on the Caring Bridge site a lot, because she had to get treatment for a health issue that she had. So I'm going to read something that she went through, and she gave me permission to say this, but it was public anyway on Caring Bridge. It was Margie, you know, she cooked for us.
Yeah.
At our retreats. Yeah?
Yeah.
Remember, Margie? So, she starts out on Caring Bridge saying, this guest house, a poem by Rumi. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He or she or they may be clearing you out for some new delight. So, yeah, may it be so, right?
Mm-hmm.
May it be so. So she writes, in her own words, in 1 week I'm going to the hospital for surgery that will deprive me of one-third of the organ responsible for allowing my body to receive the breath of life. The surgery will also be the means for determining whether I have non-invasive versus aggressive form of cancer growing in my lungs. The stakes are high. Rumi reminds me that all of this may be some kind of blessing with its own gifts to offer. My house feels swept clean. I'm somehow feeling fully alive, more than ever, with the life-threatening diagnosis right in my face. I'm re-examining my relationship to every aspect of my life and asking the questions, how does this serve me and all that is of value to me? What is of value to me anyway? I don't have all the answers, but the process has been enlivening, energizing, and sometimes fun. And so I plan to welcome my next guest honorably. That was Margie. So, may she rest in peace. So there's such a, you can tell in Margie's, I mean, I was there, just visited her just before she passed away, and she was really alive in her heart, you know, till I heard, because I was connected with her relatives, till the time of her death. And she was such a high human being. She had so much love, but she practiced, you know, all the things that we learn in the Dharma here. She was a nurse, and she would come to the retreats, and she got so much out of them that she just wanted to serve. So she came to many, many retreats just giving of herself, cooking, and just working her ass off, you know. She really did. She was working so hard to cook for us, along with the other cooks. So she had this sort of strength and vulnerability at the same time, really felt the openness of her life. So, compassion is the capacity to connect with the truth of how things are, no matter how difficult it is, and actually turn that into a pearl. Turn that into something beautiful. When the Buddha expounded on the First Noble Truth, he mentioned the hallmarks of our basic vulnerability of human beings. So, the ones I talked about before were just kind of generalizations about just opening to pain and body and all of that. But these are very specific hallmarks of dukkha that the Buddha talked about, which makes it so real. Opening to birth. You know, what is really the cause of death? Birth. So getting off the wheel is going beyond that, going out beyond birth and death, really. So that's sort of a koan in a way, so don't think about that now. So there's the birth of the child, of course, you know, the infant. Now, the Buddha didn't say this next thing, but because I'm a mother of four, and many of you are mothers out there, I want to include this one thing, that it's not only the birth of that newborn and the child, but the birthing process is damn hard, right? I mean, it's really, I gave birth to most of my children quite naturally, and the last one just fully in a natural childbirth, and it's really hard. There's a lot of pain in that. So I wanted to... Manindra always honored mothers, so I just wanted to say that in honor of all mothers. And even if you're not a mother, you've had a mother. So you've got to honor that. So the birthing process. And then the Buddha said birth is one of the hallmarks of our basic vulnerability as human beings. Sickness, vulnerability, aging, death, and the dying process included in that. Being with those we don't like. It's actually part of it. Uh-huh. Being separated from those we love by death or any other way. Wanting to have and keep what is pleasant. But it doesn't last, right? It could be for a long time, but really, how long could it be? Running away and avoiding the unpleasant. I mean, that's dukkha too. I mean, just the very fact of feeling and seeing the unpleasant and running away from it. And then, but it comes back, maybe in another form. So all of this is undeniable. And our inner response to those conditions are usually attachment, aversion, in some form of despair, anxiety, or grief, or we just ignore it, or we just go into delusion about it. And so, you know, that's the way it is. They're strong, deep habit patterns that we experience over and over and over again, like trenches in the mind. You know, some of you have practiced in Santa Rosa with Dennis and John, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is what I heard when I was there one year, that I was teaching there one time, and a long time ago, and people would walk on the grounds around. I don't know how it is now, but she said, you know, I see in the mind so many cow paths in the mind. Like, because she realized that she was walking around, and there would be places she would walk, and she wouldn't even see it, but her foot would fall into some trench, some cow path. Like, sometimes you can't see it because it's strange how it can be a cow path. You know, they've got these four legs. I mean, this is... But this path is like so... They're able to go like this with each foot. And so the trench is really deep sometimes. The cow paths of our mind. And that's what she called it. The cow paths of my mind. She said, I found them here at this retreat center. The cow paths of my mind. So we're learning to understand the habit patterns so clearly. And it's not always, pleasant, right? Like Mark Twain said, self-knowledge is not always good news. It's really hard. So coming to this path is really hard. Like one time I was reading a spy book, and just because, you know, I wanted to avoid life, right? Too much. Let me read a spy book. So I was reading this, and then there was this part in that said, oh, what do you do when you're not spying, or something like that? And the guy said, well, I practice vipassana. And then the other guy says, what? He said, that's the hardest thing you could ever do. I mean, they were spies, you know, and they were just kind of sneaking around and carrying these whatever to blow people up, or, you know, or run away, or being this danger all the time. And this guy said, that's really hard, you know, to do that. So, you know, we ought to be really kind of in a good way proud of ourselves here. Like we're here doing what we're doing. So a long time ago, Carl Jung's statement about what enlightenment is set me straight, so that I wouldn't have this wrong view of this practice. And I heard this from Jack Kornfield a long time ago. He said, this quote by Carl Jung, enlightenment doesn't mean envisioning bodies of light, but making the darkness known. That was really important that time. So compassion in the etymological dictionary is broken down like this. The first three letters, calm, or like, you know, in the Latin language is con, means together with, means with. And then passion, that part in pasión, is suffering. You know, so compassion is to being together with suffering, coming together with suffering. That's how they broke the that word down to express what it really means, being together with suffering. It's the willingness to allow parts of ourselves we're not proud of to be known. You know, like shame and of whatever in our lives or presently. And feeling confused and not feeling good enough and all that stuff we open to. So it gives us this gentleness of humility. You know, humility is not the same as humiliation. You know, it's a part of our lives that can really bow to the truth. You know, in Hawaii we have a lot of Japanese people, and they really love this particular plant. I forget what it is right now, But the flowers bow down. Mm-hmm. And it's more like the flowers aren't kind of upright, but they kind of bow down like that. And that it's kind of bowing to life. You know, and when you make yourself humble, then you really can be honest with yourself and be honest with others too. So it's that humility, and you're not ashamed of it. You're not ashamed of being vulnerable. It's not, you're not humiliated by it. We can be humiliated by a lot of things, but not the truth of life. I know I read a lot of poems, and you know, by great people like Rumi and Mark Nepo and Markova. But this one came from the Celestial Seasonings tea box. And I thought it was really great because it just reminds us of something really important. And it says, flowers unfold slowly and gently, bit by bit in the sunshine. And a heart, too, must never be pushed or driven, but unfold in its own perfect timing to reveal its true wonder and beauty. And so I encourage you to be able to just let things unfold and not be whatever it is you are, you know, in facing what's being unfolded. So just to be able to say, okay, this is part of life. This is the first noble truth. If I don't get here, then the others really can't unfold because we're either avoiding or running away or, you know, holding on to it all. So hopefully we can all do that in our lives. And granted, we may not radically change the world when we practice compassion and wisdom, but in fact, we're transforming our own hearts. And that's a real possibility. I mean, when I think that, you know, I can transform the world or do what I can so the whole world is transformed, it's daunting for me. But you know what? I know I can transform my heart. It may take a few lifetimes, but I know that that can happen. I'm really sure of that. Maybe sooner than later. Maybe. So His Holiness, the Dalai Lama again says, compassion doesn't make the atrocities of the world disappear or see them as right. It just stops those atrocities from continuing in our own hearts. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's how it is. That's the truth. So let's sit for a moment and just let the words dissolve. For this, for your contemplation and your benefit, and may your life lead in the direction of the end of suffering. Thank you.